Please turn this morning to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy chapter 25, beginning with verse 1. If there is a dispute between men and they come into court and the judges decide between them, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty, then if the guilty man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence with a number of stripes in proportion to his offense. 40 stripes may be given him, but not more, lest if one should go on to beat him with more stripes than these, your brother be degraded in your sight. You shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, and if he persists, saying, "I do not wish to take her," then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull off his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off." When men fight with one another and the wife of one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who is beating him, and puts out her hand and seizes him by the private parts, then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall have no pity. You shall not have in your bag two kinds of weights, a large and a small. You shall not have in your house two kinds of measures, a large and a small. A full and fair weight you shall have, a full and fair measure you shall have, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. For all who do such things, all who act dishonestly, are an abomination to the Lord your God. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt, how he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary, and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind, and did not fear God. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you, in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. Let us pray. Lord, thank you so much for this word you've given, that you're giving us guidelines, giving us rules, giving us principles to follow, that we may have blessed lives, orderly lives, and that you may see our various societies founded upon justice instead of founded upon the rule of men who are fallible, who are fickle, who do not have wisdom, because you were the only source of wisdom. Thank you for giving us your law. Please help us to take it to heart and to learn from it today. In Christ's name, amen.
If you will turn to the 25th chapter of Deuteronomy, and I think as was mentioned last week, this first section, first four verses at least, back up, first three verses at least, have some connection with the previous chapter. And I'm reading from the ESV version. We're going to take this a section at a time. Bear with me. Deuteronomy 25 verse 1 says, if there is a dispute between men and they come into court and the judges decide between them, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty, then if the guilty man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence with a number of stripes in proportion to his offense. 40 stripes may be given him, but not more, lest if one should go on to beat him with more stripes than these, your brother be degraded in your sight. You remember that we have Paul's testimony in the New Testament, specifically, let's see, and I didn't write down the reference. But Paul tells us at one point, and I think it was 1 Corinthians, I believe, he said that five times I received 40 lashes, less one. And this is the law concerning that. Now, verse 2 says, if the guilty man deserves to be beaten, which means that there is room for mercy in this case, in many cases, depending on the offense. But if he deserves to be beaten, he can only, the limit is 40 lashes. Now, I understand from one of the commentators that when they scourged a man, they used a scourge that, I don't know how to describe this, I should have written it down. It had three, three cords, I'll call them cords. And every time they struck the guilty man with the scourge and those cords, each strike was counted as three stripes. So that when they that guaranteed that they would not go beyond 40 stripes, because if they got to 39, they had to stop, because if they hit them again, it'd be 40. Two. So now the severity of the offense determined the number of stripes. It might have been a half a dozen, it might have been two dozen, but no more than 40. And I another commentator that I read said that the way the Jews figured it, if the man were as strong as Samson, he could take 40 lashes. But most men were not. So it depended on the offense, the number of stripes. And I understand, and if the commentators that I've read have it right, that the man was in a kneeling, not necessarily in a laying position, but he was beat with stripes on his shoulder and on his back. Who would determine this? let's talk about this. Verse 3, 40 stripes may be given him, but not more. And the reason for that, if you should go on to beat him with more, your brother might be degraded in your sight. And the best that I can ascertain from what I've read is that it had to do with the danger of being physically maimed for life, becoming lame or deformed or so contemptible rather than just returning to his former state and not having a physical reminder or a physical display to the public to remind them of what you had done. Now, the question is, where would this happen? Who was authorized to do this? And I found in reading that there was a system that originated in the book of Genesis with the great council, and the courts were of three types. First was the greater Sanhedrin, and it was composed of 70 men plus the high priest, so a total of 71 persons. They met, according to what I've read, they met every day in Jerusalem. They met only in Jerusalem. They did not meet on the Sabbath day, but they met every other day. There was a lesser Sanhedrin. And of course, the greater Sanhedrin was the Supreme Court. And we know that Jesus appeared before that, and three or four of his disciples did later on in the book of Acts. There were lesser Sanhedrins, and they were held in every city that had at least 120 Israelites. There was 23 people in each of the lesser Sanhedrins. And the last level was a very local level. And in places where there was not 120 Israelites, there was what was called a triumvirate. And it was a bench of three judges, and only three judges, and they held court in their local synagogue. And the reason I mention this, that Jesus had warned his disciples in Matthew 10:17, warned his disciples that men would hand them over to their councils and scourge them in their synagogues. And these were points, supposedly, they were to be the points of justice for the Israelites. Any questions, any comments? Okay. Chapter 25, verse 4 says, "You shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain." You shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out the grain. We are familiar with this. Because in the New Testament, it's echoed in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 9. How about if somebody reads that for us? 1 Corinthians 9. You know what? I'm going to read it. It's too long. From verse 9 through verse 14. 1 Corinthians 9:9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 9. "For it is written in the law of Moses, 'You shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain.' Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak for our sake? It was written for our sake, because the plowman should plow in hope, and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. If we, this is Paul speaking, remember, if we have sown spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share this rightful claim on you, do not we even more? Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. Moving on, chapter 25, verse 5. If brothers dwell together, one of them dies. By the way, these are miscellaneous laws. Some of them have a connection to each other, some of them don't. William? Well, not one judge, of course, could not. That's why they had a plurality of judges. Three at the local synagogue, 23 in the city with 120 Israelites, and then the greater Sanhedrin was actually the Supreme Court, and their focus actually went beyond just their immediate... I mean, they covered the entire nation. Oh. Okay.
So you're saying, like, we don't see any biblical scriptures that say, if so-and-so does so-and-so, then 20 lashes.
Right.
We don't see that, but yet they are implementing lashes.
Right. So could it be that any sin a judge could determine
worthy of lashes?
Yeah. I'm going to give you some lashes here. But it could be a thing of some of these things that I've always assumed there was no, you don't see no specific, just tells you not to do it, but there's never any specific thing that's going to happen to you. There's no death penalty, another little, pluck your eye out, you hurt somebody's eye, nothing specific is ever mentioned, but it may fall under this general category.
From what I have been able to determine, it was discretionary, and we'll mention this later in verses 11 and 12. My understanding, I've always wondered, one of my favorite commentators is John Gill. He comes up with things that I've never heard of before, and one of the people that he mentions by name in his commentary, I looked it up this week, and he was in the 12th century the premier authority on Moses' law. His name was Moses Maimonides. He was a astronomer, he was a physician, he was a Sephardic Jew, that meant from Spain, and much of what he wrote included what had come to be accepted in Israel and in the Jewish community everywhere as kind of standard operating procedures. And so in some of the commentaries, there are lists of things that could be brought before the courts. But as far as I know, there wasn't a specific, you know, if there wasn't a specific mention of numbers of lashes. So it could be from 1 to 40, but no further. If the death penalty was required, it didn't have to come before the court. But the court would issue out judgment according or in proportion to the offense. I don't know. Was somebody else over here going to say something? I thought I saw you.
Yeah, we had another instance. I can't remember where it was. Where it said that beating was the penalty. I can't remember where it was. I think it was when we were talking about the man who accused his wife of not being a virgin. He was to not only have to take her back as a wife and take care of her, never be able to divorce her, but he was to be beaten.
Mm-hmm. But I don't remember it. Did it say a specific number of lashes? Well, I mean, it was. We're going to find out that.
He had fine and was to be whipped.
A lot of, and we'll get into this just very shortly. The rabbis and those who were in the greater and the lesser Sanhedrin and the triumvirate, they sometimes took it upon themselves to commute a sentence. It seems like they sometimes really got carried away. But if they were a part of that body and the body voted, that was the punishment. Anybody else? Okay. All right. Starting in verse 5, Deuteronomy 25. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in to her, take her as his wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Okay. One verse at a time. If brothers dwell together, what does that tell you? You know, these were clans living together. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, what does that tell you?
I would assume that
one is married. One is not married.
How does it say that? God does not demand that.
Did the Jews practice polygamy?
Yes.
But it wasn't authorized. It was not according to the law. Am I right? There may not have been a prohibition. But I'm thinking it was not a standard practice, to say the least.
Very possibly it wasn't standard. I mean, you know, the more wives you had, the more you had to be able to support. So some people couldn't. I mean, that was part of the covenant. I mean, part of what you were a part of doing in the covenant. So I don't know about how common it was.
Okay. All right. Let me go through the verse and see if we can rectify this. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. This was an ancient tradition. It's mentioned in Genesis 38 chapter verses 8 through 11. Undoubtedly, Moses and this is known as the, what do they call it? I lost it. It's got a name, but I didn't write the name down. Well, in the Hebrew, there was a name for it, and it talked, it meant the brother-in-law marrying the wife, something that to that effect. Moses recognized its value. It didn't originate with the Jews, but he saw its value, so he included it in the Torah, and its purpose was to carry on the inheritance in Israel, because the spiritual and physical heritage for the Jews was given to Abraham and his seed in Genesis chapter 12 verses 1 through 3. So it was necessary to produce children to carry on the promise of God. So the family would preserve its name and its spiritual heritage by having a son who would perpetuate the family line. Now, sometimes there was no son, and so allowance was made. The wife of the dead man was not to be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And there is then this in verse 8. He has a choice. If the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of his city can call him and speak to him. Of course, they would encourage him to do this. And if he persists saying, "I do not wish to take her," then his brother's wife not can, but shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, pull his sandal off his foot, and spit in his face. She shall answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house." And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. This is highly unusual, and it doesn't really, I guess the word is jive with what we think of as normal activity for a woman to pursue. And later on, I'm told by the commentators that the rabbis actually softened this and said it didn't really mean spit in his face, but spit beyond an eye-to-eye basis with him, spit on the ground. They changed the meaning to soften the blow. But this was quite radical for a woman to do that in those days, and the symbolism of the sandal, I've seen several explanations for it, was that the way that a person showed ownership was to actually travel around, I don't know if it was the perimeter, but to walk on the grounds to show his ownership of that plot of land. To take the sandal off was a symbol of someone losing a heritage. And I saw one commentator that likened the separation of the foot from the sandal as being a man that was not worthy to be married. The idea of going barefooted, especially in some of the rocky places, was not something that they would think to do. So there was also a symbolism there that this person who had done this did not deserve a wife, and it may have caused problems, personal problems, in the way that women would look upon a man who had done this. I also read that sometimes later, and this is outside of God's word now, that there was a way to get around this that the Jews took. If the brother agreed to be the kinsman redeemer, he was later, at a later time, and I can't tell you what year, but I think this came from Maimonides in the 12th century, recorded. He was required by canon law to wait 3 months or 90 days from the husband's death to determine if the wife was pregnant or not by the deceased husband. So they worked their way around this law, that more or less canceled that in practical application in the Jewish community. Okay. Later, this is God's law. There's no doubt about it. Verses 5 through 10 talk about the kinsman. Oh, it's what they call the levirate marriage. It meant the brother marrying the wife. This was the law of God, but in later centuries, actually, this was no longer required by the local leaders of the Sanhedrins. In other words, they passed what to them was a law that actually conflicted with what was here, and said that they were required to wait, that the kinsman redeemer was required to wait 3 months or 90 days from the husband's death to determine if the wife was pregnant or not by the deceased husband. Okay? I don't know. So the woman's husband dies. That means they're, and they have no son.
Well, the thing for that is they may have a son.
They may have a son, yeah. And they don't know. Right. So if he marries her a month after the death, and then she turns up pregnant, it defeats the whole idea that that name is to be carried on. It could, if there is a pregnancy, and from what I can't give you I didn't write down who the commentator is that brought this up, But it was a way to get around the law, so to speak.
I just don't understand how waiting 3 months gets you around the law. It just delays it 3 months. What difference is 3 months make? I mean, in 3 months, the law would kick in and say, okay, well, no evidence of pregnancy. Now, what will you do?
But if she was pregnant?
Well, yeah, if she was pregnant, but the special case is probably that she wasn't.
If she was pregnant, then there wouldn't be a need for.
But she might not know.
Yeah, I'm saying she found out later.
For 2 or 3 months.
3 months, and she's pregnant. I would think then you've got to wait 9 months. I mean, you've got to wait till the baby's born because you don't know if it's got the male.
That's true too.
I hadn't thought about that.
But still, all it does is it seems to me it doesn't like. To me, it doesn't like make it where it doesn't have to be done or it can't be done. It just delays.
It actually, and I didn't record it this way, but it, she could not marry. You could not marry within 3 months or 90 days. It was outlawed after the death of a husband when there's no heir apparent.
It delays it.
It was a way around the law, I guess. I'm not 100% certain I can explain it.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so we went through verse 10. Starting in verse 11, and again, I'm reading from the ESV. Chapter 25, verse 11, when men fight with one another. When men fight with one another, and the wife of the one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who is beating him, puts out her hand and seizes him by the private parts, then you shall cut off her hand, your eye shall have no pity. Okay, the previous law that we just read about, verses 5 through 10, the levirate marriage law, in the foregoing law, the woman was to complain against her husband's brother for not marrying her and to spit in his face before the elders. That was kind of radical. And it needed a good measure of assurance. The woman had to be assured that that was the thing to do. She could do that and there would not be any... the word
consequences
is the word. Okay. So that the confidence which that law supported, so that wouldn't become would grow to an excess, unbecoming women in general. Here's a very severe law, but a just law to punish impudence and immodesty. So, verse 12 says, then you shall cut off her hand, your eye shall have no pity. Now, we understand from past lessons in the Old Testament that the eye for an eye, the tooth for a tooth, meant what we said in verse 2, that the offense or the punishment was required to be in proportion to the offense. The punishment had to be in proportion to the offense. So I found very little, very few commentators had to even wanted to discuss verse 11 and 12. And there were some attempts, but John Gill actually drew a conclusion based on 11 and 12 that I wasn't too sure about. And this is what he said. He said, this immodest action was done partly out of affection to her husband to oblige his antagonist to let go his hold of him, and partly out of malice and revenge to him. The way Gill worded it, to spoil him, to physically hurt him to the point and make him unfit for generation, for the production of children in the future, and therefore was to be severely punished, as it follows in verse 12. But question is, did they cut off a woman's hand in a situation like this? What do you think the Old Testament would allow? But in many cases, the law was commuted, and it was not through beatings, but it was through the most severe of fines. And I think the majority of cases wherever it actually came up, and I think that was probably very few, that the judges would commute the sentence to the most severe financial punishment that they could think of at the time.
That would seem to go against the phrase there, you shall not have pity on her. In other words, you don't say, oh, that seems a little drastic. I think we'll just let that slide. It's saying, no, you don't let it slide.
I can't answer that for sure. I think what Gill said would be a way to figure out the proportion of guilt, or maybe the motive. If the motive was just affection for her husband, and
he may be making the assumption that there was damage done.
Right. Right. If it was purely malice, how could you know that?
I like Gill a lot. You have to, but Gill is very learned in the Talmud, which are the extra biblical Jewish laws and extra biblical Jewish traditions.
Right.
And it's very helpful sometimes to hear what those are in relation when it's sort of vague to us. But you can't go so far as to say, you come up with definitive, when the verse is as definitive as it is here, like William just said. The fact that they may have been doing a different thing doesn't justify what they were doing. It doesn't mean that was right. We have to go with what the text says. Right. And I agree with you. You have to be careful when you're reading commentaries, or people give a commentary. There's a whole bunch of, like, it would seem to me that this was going on. There's a whole lot of that is in there. Yeah. And you pretty much have to take that with a really small grain of salt, a really big grain of salt. When somebody, Calvin's really bad about that, from what I've read.
The problem with this particular, just two verses, I consulted a number of sources. They didn't want to discuss it. They didn't. I think if they wanted to, they would have. I know what I'm thinking of. And I've got what Matthew Henry said, but it's not too definitive. One commentary said that the very fact of what happened physically might have been considered at the time adultery.
Yeah, again, grain of salt. So I think he's sort of just being taken, like,
I want
some commentary on this. So no.
I got one just like that. So
I'll finish what I'm saying. So, I mean, when it might have, could have, whatever, I mean, our duty is to simply read what it says. I mean, this actually has, you know, there's other verses that speak to this. Like, mm-hmm. You know, you've got to still have two or three witnesses. You still got to prove things. You can't just, like, go off without any kind of, like, mm-hmm. You know, you can't just have one witness being the guy who got grabbed or whatever.
Right.
I mean, you can't have that. I mean, you've got to have proper, all the rest of the law applying to this correctly. But if it does, then there's no reason not to follow what the law says.
And therefore, I'm going to read verse 12. Then you shall cut off her hand. Your eye shall have no pity. We should never think that we need to be more merciful than God is. And I'll leave it there. Verse 13, on a new subject, another miscellaneous law. Deuteronomy, okay, we're going to read verse 13 through 16. And verse 13 says, you shall not have in your bag two kinds of weights, a large and a small. You shall not have in your house two kinds of measures, a large and a small. A full and fair weight you shall have. A full and fair measure you shall have, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord is giving you. For all who do such things, that is, all who act dishonestly, are what? An abomination to the Lord your God. Now, what does that mean? What is that all about? You shall not have in your bag two kinds of weights, a large and a small. What's the alternative? Well, we have to know something about the marketplace, how goods were exchanged in the Old Testament community. And everything was done, or most everything was done by weight. And you had to have something to determine the weight. Now, those who were dishonest would have, instead of, let's say, a 1 pound weight, let's just take that as an example. They want to get a pound of what?
Cream.
Grain. Okay, a pound of grain. This is the same for the weight and the measure. The measure would have been some kind of a container in which you put a certain amount of grain into. If you're dishonest, you would carry two weights. One you would use for buying, and the other you would use for selling. The idea was dishonesty, to make a dishonest gain against the person that you're buying or selling. So that's not allowed. And it goes for the weights, and it goes for the measures. You should have a full and fair weight, a full and fair measure to record your transactions or to go through your transactions. To be honest, that your what? That your days may be long. What does that sound like? This is a law with promise. What's the most famous law with promise in the Ten Commandments? Anybody? Honor that your days
may be long
in the land that God has given you. So this is important. It's so important. It's all through the Old Testament and the New Testament. But I want to just read quickly two verses that echo the same thing that we see in verses 13 through 16. Proverbs 11:1 says, a false balance is abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is his delight. Proverbs 20 and verse 10 says, diverse weights, that means different weights, and diverse measures, different measures, both of them are alike abomination to the Lord. And verse 16 concludes that section. Can't read this two ways. For all who do such things, that is, all who act dishonestly, are an abomination to the Lord your God. Can't add anything to that. Questions or comments?
So it might be wise to maybe keep up your own weight handy, to keep your own weight handy.
This weight?
If you question somebody's weight they have, you can test it.
If it's accurate, sure.
Well, you know it's accurate if you got your own weight to throw up on the scale with their weight.
Right, right. Okay. All right. Verses 17 through 19 read this way. Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt. How he attacked you on the way, when you were faint and weary, and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, and he did not fear God. Therefore, when the Lord your God has given you rest from all your enemies around you, in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance to possess, you shall blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. You shall not forget. You remember the story in Exodus as children of Israel were leaving Egypt and going towards the promised land. Amalek, the people known as the Amalekites, came out and attacked the Israelites for no obvious reason. So they not only came out against them unprovoked, the Israelites had not done anything to get this response or this aggression, but they were the aggressors. They fell upon them as they were traveling on the road, And when they were just come out of Egypt, where they had been in hard bondage, and their spirits broken, and they were not used to war. And so took them at all these disadvantages, a people that had not at, in the least injured them. If you remember the story, Moses was lacking strength when the Amalekites attacked, and he held up his hands, and the battle went to the Israelites, but because he was weak to some degree, his arms would fall down, and the battle would go to the Amalekites. So what happened? Anybody remember?
Joshua and some other guy held his hands up.
Held Moses' hands up?
Arms.
Pardon?
Arms up.
What'd I say?
I said hands.
Arms. Yeah, held his arms up, and the battle was won. The sad thing was that the stragglers, those who lagged behind them, were the ones that caught the brunt of the beginning of the attack. And who would that have been? Who would have been the slowest? There was close to half a million to a million. I forget what they speculated the group numbered. It was the old and the infirm, possibly mothers with children. It says here, you shall not forget and to blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. In Exodus 17th chapter, it says, then the Lord said to Moses, that at that time, write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under sun, under heaven. And that's in the law. And the law is, you shall not forget. Don't forget what happened as you came out. Why? A reminder of how God, at every step of the way, was their source of strength, their only strength, their only power. And it's part of the law.